From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The Republic of Korea, or South Korea, has proposed talks with North Korea, or the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Those talks could take place as early as this week, according to Seoul, which says the negotiations may ease tensions and establish long-awaited peace on the Korean Peninsula, where the two states are technically still at war. South Korea's new president, Moon Jae-in, has clearly stated that he will never pursue the collapse of the North and an absorption-based reunification. That position was reiterated by the South's unification minister, Cho Myung-young, at a news briefing Monday. The last time talks took place between Seoul and Pyongyang was in December of 2015. Last month, South Korea's president told CBS News,
"So I believe what Kim Jong-un would want the most is to have a security guarantee for his regime. So there is a possibility that Kim Jong-un continues to make the bluff with his nuclear weapons programs, but deep inside he is actually yearning or wanting dialogue. But in the end, the only way to find out is to have a dialogue with North Korea."
For more on all of that, and in particular, the relevant history and context, we spoke with Brian Becker. He hosts a daily radio program on Radio Sputnik called Loud and Clear. He's also a co-founder of both the Answer Coalition and the Party for Socialism and Liberation here in the United States. We spoke with him via Skype from Washington, D.C., Monday. Brian, thank you for giving us some of your time. I know you're very busy. So let's jump into what's going on in the Korean Peninsula.
Sure. So, of course, there's following the toppling of the Park Geun-hye South Korean right-wing government for corruption and the ascension to the presidency of Moon Jae-in, a liberal former human rights lawyer, someone who was associated with the earlier liberal government starting with Kim Dae-jung in the late 1990s, there's a lot of hopefulness that perhaps there could be a relaxation of tensions on the Korean Peninsula. And Moon Jae-in seems to be making, although, you know, you might not have known it from his trip to Washington, where he met with Trump and basically functioned as a prop for Trump's huffing and puffing against North Korea. It looks to me that Moon Jae-in and his government is very eager, in fact, to change inter-Korea atmospherics, at least, and perhaps more, and is open to having negotiations between the North and the South. This, of course, would be very welcome in North Korea, and it would be, in fact, the precondition for a change in U.S. policy towards the DPRK if the Trump administration so chose to make a change. Obama's policy of strategic patience, so-called, which is kind of a joke, which was remaining patient, not negotiating, expecting the fall of the DPRK's government. That was a complete flop. In fact, all the DPRK did was get stronger militarily. It developed its nuclear weapons capability. It developed its rocketry, missile rocketry during that same period. So the Trump administration is faced with a real dilemma. They've said that they're going to renounce strategic patience. They demanded that China put pressure on North Korea to stop testing missiles or nuclear weapons, which China has absolutely no capability to do. But absent any success or any progress, the Trump administration and the Pentagon are confronted with the real option, maybe the only viable option from a U.S. even military point of view, which is to open up talks with the DPRK and develop what's called a dual track arrangement whereby North Korea may freeze its nuclear weapons program. They're not going to get rid of them, but freeze further developments and perhaps freeze some of the missile technology developments where they are now in exchange for the beginning of a normalization of relations between the U.S. and the DPRK. In other words, where the U.S. would start to incrementally perhaps end sanctions and begin talks towards a peace treaty. We'll have to see. There's one other thing, Don, that's really important for our audience to know, which only, you know, all of us only receive very caricatured, stereotypical and demonizing images of North Korea. But the North Korean economy is growing very robustly. So the government is not on its last legs. In fact, the Financial Times, reported that they believe the DPRK may be the fastest growing economy in the world.
Right, that's right.
A 9% growth rate. So anyway, Trump and the Pentagon have to make a decision. Stay with a failed policy that won't change. They can't really easily militarily attack North Korea because North Korea is quite strong militarily. And if they don't come to some agreement with North Korea, North Korea is just going to keep going, regardless of how many UN resolutions are passed. They're going to keep going and improving their rocketry, their missile technology, and their nuclear weapons program.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at a condition here. First of all, just for our listeners, the you know, we're not talking about a policy of benign neglect by the United States, but some rather affirmative and aggressive actions. You mentioned, for example, sanctions. I mean, there's virtually, you know, as oppressive a condition of sanctions against DPRK as there are against Cuba. And the ones in Cuba, of course, as we know, are so oppressive that on an annual basis, something like 98% of the nation states on the planet vote to condemn them and call for their removal. You also have a legal state of war, essentially, that still exists by the between the United States and Korea with the DPRK, with the United States refusing to sign a peace treaty. And certainly since the 1990s, twice a year, you know, these semi-annual invasion rehearsals, where they call war games, but they are, in essence, the military mobilizes and, you know, starts an invasion and then just stops at the border, leaving the DPRK's defenses in a position of, well, are they going to come in this time or not? So they have to mobilize and get prepared to fight an existential war. That's the condition of relations between the U.S. and DPRK at the moment.
Exactly. I mean, North Korea is a pretty small country. I think it's got maybe 28 million people. The Korean people as a whole, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica in 1967, lost about 5 million people who would not have died otherwise if the war had not taken place. Huge, almost genocidal type proportions. The U.S. government carpet bombed North Korea and also invaded North Korea and also used huge amounts of napalm and white phosphorus on North Korea. The main complaint of American pilots by December 1950, that was two and a half years before the war ended, was that there was nothing left to bomb in North Korea because there wasn't one structure taller than one story still standing.
Right.
And yet the U.S. bombed for another two and a half years. So when you carry out biannual exercises, so-called war games, as you said, that are really appear to be the invasion and the destruction of North Korea, but right. They just stop short. They don't use real bombs when they, by the way, they used a nuclear bomb dropping drill 3 weeks ago.
Nice.
If you're in North Korea's point of view and you have that kind of history, you have to prepare. You have to get ready every 6 months for your country to be invaded. You have to go into high alert. And for a small country with limited resources and a very sanctioned country, that means diverting all of this money to the military in preparation for these biannual defense from invasions. And one of the things, and the North Korean government talks about this openly now, is that nuclear weapons are reducing their military expenditures because with simply a conventional weapon capability, they may not be able to inflict enough damage to actually stop an American invasion. But with nuclear weapons, you know, it reaches a whole level of violence, of destructiveness, and that they think allows a real deterrent to exist, and right. that then allows them to redirect parts of their budget away from the military.
And you know, just for people who aren't accustomed to thinking in these terms, if you look at the behavior of the United States in terms of how it's treated its perceived adversaries, Iraq, Libya, etc., first they starve them, and they also make sure that they have no strategic military capability, and they get rid of whatever weapons of mass destruction that they could have. In other words, as DPRK looks at the landscape where the smoldering remains of these nations exist, that first they surrendered or had taken away from them their strategic capacity to deter, in the case of Iraq, in the case of Libya, and then the destruction comes in. So the United States doesn't like to get involved in a fight if it can get its hair mussed up, so to speak, if you can call an atomic or nuclear attack that. But first it removes that. And so, they, at one level, they'd have to be out of their minds to give up their ability to strike back under the conditions that they face right now.
Yeah, the DPRK's position is not irrational. It's not crazy. It's completely rational and completely sane, as you mentioned. And, one thing, if you think about Iraq, for instance, since we're referencing Iraq and Libya. Ramsey Clark, former U.S. Attorney General, who I think was the foremost expert really on what was happening in Iraq because he was there all the time. He was writing to the United Nations every 2 months about the impact of sanctions during the 1990s. Every 2 months he did another report using U.N. data, U.N. indices, to the U.N. General Assembly, documenting that sanctions themselves took such a terrible humanitarian toll. I mean, in the case of Iraq, 8,000 people died every month from sanctions, according to the UN Sanctions Committee.
Right.
5,000 of those 8,000 were children under the age of five. 3,000 more were mainly their grandparents. In other words, the more vulnerable, weaker parts of society that are more dependent on food and medicine.
Right. I mean, the aggregate was for children was in the neighborhood of 500,000 at the time that they asked Madeleine Albright about it when she said it was worth it.
Yeah, she said a tough question about whether it's worth the loss of 5 million babies to sanctions. She said, that's a tough question. But yeah, I think it's worth it. I mean, how is killing 500,000 children worth it? Anyway, that aside, one of the things that Ramsey pointed out in his studies was that when the U.S. decided to bomb downtown Baghdad and bomb the sanitation system and the water system and the electric grid in 1991, purportedly to defend Kuwait, which was, far away from downtown Baghdad. the military planners were quoted as saying, and one of the Air Force generals, I forget his name right now, was dismissed because he kind of spilled the beans. He said the targeting was designed to enhance the impact of sanctions. So if you have sanctions whereby people can't buy spare parts for an electrical grid or for a water water purification or human sewage system. If you can't buy the spare parts, if you can't buy what you need, if you can't buy the chemical ingredients like chlorine, etc., and then you bomb the hell out of them, out of the basic infrastructure, you can't replace them. And thus, civilian life itself becomes in many ways fundamentally unsustainable as a consequence of this combination, sanctions and war, sanctions and military blasts. Wow. And I remember too, Don, because I think it's extremely important for all these so-called liberal social democrats who made up a big part of the American peace movement, unlike the wing of the movement that I was a part of. People were chanting at the time, sanctions, not war.
Yeah,
like,
right.
We have to punish Iraq. Of course, we, America, have to punish Iraq. But sanctions we should do that because then it's not so bloody as military bombs blasting. But in fact, it is. It is just as bloody. It's just as awful. And it also shows why the peace movement per se must have a holistic and anti-imperialist orientation towards these questions rather than just protesting against war because it's the absence of so-called peace. If you have peace but economic sanctions killing kids, that's not peace.
Yeah, not at all. And you know, when you take a couple of elements like this and assemble them together, as has been done at free, as policy by the U.S. government, you're talking about Nuremberg-level war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Oh, no question about it. The problem with war crimes, crimes against humanity and crimes against peace, it's completely predicated on victor's justice.
Right, right.
So the Nazis could be in the dock for Nuremberg, and when I can't remember whether it was Goring or who, one of the Nazi leaders said, well, what about Hiroshima?
Right.
He was told to shut up.
Right.
In other words, you know, the Nazis obviously were the biggest criminals going, capitalist, imperialist, fascist criminals. I'm using those words not as rhetoric. That's who they actually were. But the United States and Britain, I don't know, those were parallel criminal operations. If you talk to people in India, for instance, who lived under hundreds of years of British colonial rule, it probably felt a lot like fascism to them.
Yeah, you think? And also, you know, look around the landscape. The Dutch, for example, in Congo, millions of people murdered. And by the way, the founding fathers were the heirs to a stolen continent that was basically made vacant to a large degree by genociding the people who were here almost into oblivion. That's the foundation of the country. So, you know, you could excuse their thinking that this is the natural order, I guess.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, Ronald Reagan said the Contras in Nicaragua were the moral equivalents of the founding fathers of the United States.
Yeah, he was right.
I think he's right there. They were Somoza's foot soldiers, the dictatorship. But yeah, if you have a situation, if you have a system, and American capitalism is premised on really, in a fundamental way, and the politics flow from the fundamentals of economics, if you have a capitalism that's built on the enslavement of people based on their point of national origin, meaning Africa, in this case, black people, and based on the theft of and genocide against indigenous nations in this vast part of the world now called North America, you can see the intertangling too, and I want to bring it back to Korea, of how racism becomes the justifier, the fundamental justifier, the public rationale in a way, for the targeting of people who the capitalist class in America have targeted. And that's the other thing that I think is missing in U.S. politics, including from the left. It's not the United States that's going to war against Libya and Iraq. It's not the United States that's imposing sanctions on North Korea. It's the United States capitalist class, which has a complete lock on all of the foreign policy establishment and all of the policy decisions by the U.S. State Department and Pentagon and the CIA. And when they go to war in far-off lands or target people or demonize them or try to overthrow their governments, that's because they're serving the interests of American capitalist companies and banks that want to dominate those areas. And then you look at who's being targeted: Libya, Iraq, North Korea, Cuba. These are the parts of the planet that have been removed from areas that were completely exploitable by Wall Street banks and corporations.
Right. Yeah, I mean, look, the biggest mistake, if you want to term it that, that the working class made, whether globally or from nation to nation, and has repeatedly made the mistake, but back in World War One, that was pointed out by people like Debs and Lenin and others, that, you know, these wars are capitalist wars, and that you have a common interest with the workers of that other country, and not with the ruling class of your country that's trying to send you to kill those workers. That's at the foundation of all of this stuff, and unless and until you know, people, in my opinion, people are not of the left unless they proceed from that point of view, that the class identity, if you're going to have identity politics, maybe one place to start would be class identity, recognizing that you don't go kill other workers because it's not in the interest of any worker to do that.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you that it's essential for an authentic left. You know, if the, you know, I'm working right now, Don, just to diverge on something called the People's Congress of Resistance in Washington, which is going to be at Howard University, September 16th and 17th, where grassroots resistors are coming from all over the world. What makes this different, all over the country, I mean, but what makes this Congress different is that unlike the liberal Democrats or even a big part of the Bernie Sanders movement, which is focused exclusively on Donald Trump and largely on a reactionary basis, not on a good basis. I mean, you could attack Trump for all kinds of and do all sorts of reactionary things. But the, quote, anti-Trump movement has been largely, you know, sort of funneled into an essentially reactionary pro-imperialist movement. The People's Congress of Resistance is going to say, if you want to resist not just Trump, but the Democratic and Republican Party elites and their orientation, whether they have the White House or the Congress or both, you have to not only fight against the exploitation and oppression of working class people here, which is growing so demonstrably by the day, you have to also stand with people overseas who are trying to resist imperialism. And you can't really be have a political revolution without being an anti-imperialist. You can't be fighting for free college at home and support the bombing of Syria or the threats against North Korea and think that that's somehow a progressive position. It's not progressive, it's reactionary.
Yeah, I mean, it's akin to the situation that we faced with Obama. You know, Malcolm, Robeson, Du Bois, all these people reminded us that the fate of African-Americans or black folks in the United States is tied to the fate of people in Africa. And that the, you know, adopting the imperialist strategy towards Africa is essentially adopting a segregationist attitude towards black folks in the United States, or worse, that if you destroy African sovereignty, as was accomplished to a large degree under President Obama, you're not doing any favors for black folks in the United States or anyone else for that matter.
Yeah, and the other part of it, which is important, at least in terms of to form a true understanding of historical processes and the interaction between our struggle here and the international struggle, it was after World War II when fascism, based on an ideology of racial supremacy, was defeated and the Cold War began, and the U.S. and the Soviet Union, which had been allies during the war, became sort of the main parties of confrontation following World War II. The Soviet Union and the communist movement could say to the United States and say to the world, oh, they say they're fighting for freedom and democracy, but they actually are built on a system of white supremacy, which is legally encoded and allowed in the United States, called Jim Crow, which is called segregation, which is called, you know, everywhere else, apartheid. And I think that had a big part to do with the parts of the ruling class in America decided to try to move away from the system of open legal apartheid against black people. The Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954 was the beginning of the process. The Congress itself was two races. You couldn't get any desegregation bills passed through Congress at that time. So the U.S. picked nine begone corporate attorneys who said, oh, wait, separate but equal is a lie, as everyone knew it was a lie. And they began to try to start to get away from the open system of legal racial supremacy in America. I think that was part of the struggle to save the image of U.S. capitalism from the critique by the communists globally, including from the Soviet Union, who made it a top part of their propaganda and agitation.
Of course. And you know, this is happening, coincides historically, and I think is, you know, derived basically, from the fact that you had, this uprising around the world against imperialism, and particularly in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, where you have people of color,
exactly.
The United States
exactly.
can't compete.
And the Middle East,
branded
Africa,
that way.
Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, all the places,
right.
all the colonial spots. The people were rising up, and you couldn't be rising up against European and American colonial domination without also rising up against racism. And,
right.
and here you had, in the United States, a vast part of the population that was being oppressed much the same way, like as an internal colony inside the United States and justified by white supremacy. So for our movement, and this is why I think it's important to study the history, to be part of the history, but also to take principled positions, to recognize that, yes, it's one global struggle against capitalism. The problem isn't just Trump. The problem is in many ways, diverging again, Don, for a moment. I was looking at old documents from a relative from the 1950s. It was leaflets for Adlai Stevenson's campaign in 1956 against Eisenhower and Richard Nixon.
Right.
And the topic of the leaflet was Eisenhower and Nixon are soft on Nasser. Eisenhower
right.
and Nixon are not true friends of Israel, blah, blah, blah. In other words, the Democrats in the middle of the Cold War, in the middle of the 1950s, were lashing out at Eisenhower and Nixon, not on a progressive basis, but that they were too close to the Egyptian revolutionary government, meaning that Nixon and Eisenhower were trying to have like a balancing act between Israel and Egypt at that time. I mean, it's really interesting to look back 60 years ago and see that we had then what we have now with Democratic Party liberal so-called establishment elites.
Yeah, I mean, Stevenson was kind of the Bernie Sanders of his day in the minds of a lot of people in the United States. And in fact, some of the revisionist caricatures or characterizations, I don't know which word to use because they both apply, I think, of the Cuba missile crisis thing, show Stevenson as, being looked at as a hopeless, idealistic, liberal, sop. And, of course, this is the kind of campaign he was running in 1956, what you just described.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I do think is different, and I felt this in terms of my own political orientation and inside the Answer Coalition, inside the PSL, Party for Socialism and Liberation, is that when the Sanders campaign was remarkable in 2016, not because of Sanders the person, but because millions of people came out for a candidate who said he was for political revolution and said he was a socialist.
Right.
And in this country of, where anti-communism and anti-socialism was the, unofficial but real religion of America for the last, ever since the end of World War II, that created a new space for people who really are for political revolution and who are really socialists to be able to speak and to be in, out. In other words, not as demonized. So that was the positive part about Sanders. The thing that we have to do is emphasize that which is positive, but not believe and not become idealistic or not become camp followers of Sanders, because at the end of the day, Sanders, who did so well and inspired so many millions of young people, folded the tent and got behind Hillary Clinton and said, well, if we don't have Hillary Clinton, we'll have Donald Trump. Well, that sort of, in my mind, is proof positive that Sanders is not capable of leading any kind of political revolution, because Hillary Clinton is the antithesis of revolution and is, in fact, the epitome of imperialism.
And, by the way, brought us Donald Trump anyway. Brian, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.